The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, Black and Country. As Mickey Guyton breaks barriers within her genre, she's more sure than ever about her place in the music industry. Undeterred by such inquiries, Guyton moved from Texas to Los Angeles after her high school graduation to pursue country music while studying at Santa Monica College. There she met entertainment executives Gary Borman and Steve Moore, who would go on to manage her. Her career started to ignite in 2011 when she moved to Nashville, landed an audition with Universal Music Group, Nashville chairman Mike Dungan, who gave her a deal on the spot. She was the first Black woman to be signed by a major country music label. But the historic moment was marred by concerns about whether she belonged. Guyton's team was so scared of her legitimacy being challenged that they suggested she visit the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum to brush up on country music history. When she did, she was greeted with a powerful work of art. There was an image of Black people picking on their porch, she recalls. Diving more into it, I learned one of country's main instruments, the banjo, came from Africa. That was enough for me, and it made me really proud to sit in this space. But being proud and knowing how to show up as your true self are two different things. And for years, Guyton says she contorted herself to fit into her industry. I was trying to be the girl next door, she explains. I used all their hairstylists and the makeup artists that they suggested. I don't even want to look back at some of those pictures. Girl, I look dusty, crusty, and gray. It was awful. It was truly, truly awful. I went on a lot of red carpets feeling really bad about myself. It wasn't just her look that wasn't working. Even with a record deal, Guyton says, no one paid her any attention, and door after door kept closing in her face. But even though the industry wasn't entirely prepared for Guyton, a conversation with her husband, Grant Savoy, helped her realize she was partially to blame. The two, who married in 2017, were sitting in a dark Los Angeles bar by themselves, having a deep healing conversation about their marriage. When Guyton changed the subject and asked about her other love. Now that we're being honest, she recalls saying, why do you think country music isn't working for me? Her husband's answer left her floored. He said, you're running away from everything that makes you different. You're running away from your Blackness. Guyton says the message from Savoy, who is Black, Japanese, and Portuguese descent, was the biggest gut check she'd experienced in her life. But Savoy didn't just relay a hard reality. He offered a solution. You need to write country music from your perspective and your perspective only, being a Black woman. She remembers him saying, Guyton heeded his advice. I literally flew back to Nashville that week and I wrote a song called Black Like Me and another song called Love My Hair, she says. After I did that, I went through my Instagram, and anything that felt inauthentic to me, I scrapped it. Guyton also went to her label and told her team that they needed to extend their knowledge beyond country music, I said. The same way that I have learned to be comfortable in a room of people who don't look like me. It's your turn to learn and feel what it's like to be in rooms with people who don't look like you. The moment was cathartic, Guyton recalls, but she didn't stop there. I started trying to find other Black women who love country music, who might not get opportunities because people don't assume that Black girls like country music. And we do, she says. We deserve to be in any space that we want to be in. These days, the country community has no choice but to accept Guyton as the real deal. Black Like Me was nominated for a Grammy for Best Solo Country Performance in 2021, making Guyton the first Black woman to be nominated in the category. This year, she received 3 more Grammy nominations for her song, Remember Her Name. Yet, with all of the accolades, there are still those who question the presence of Guyton and other Black artists in country music. After this year's CMT Music Awards, reporter Patrick Howley remarked on the number of Black celebrities at the awards show, saying, "It's not Wakanda." Guyton, who has endured years of race-based abuse online and once suffered from anxiety as a result, says she no longer loses sleep over these types of comments. "It's like, I can't help you," Guyton says, in reference to Harley. "Go do what you do, and then go praise Jesus afterward. Like you did something. Congratulations. Get it out. Good for you." No longer interested in proving her place as a country music artist, Guyton is clear about her purpose and excited to open the doors for others, to watch other Black girls be seen and get their opportunities in this industry. "I think that is just the coolest part of all of this," she says. "Nothing else is as exciting as watching that for me." And for those who might not agree with that sentiment, Guyton has a sobering truth that she delivers in a way only a country artist can. "We're not going to stop," she says simply. The next article is titled Blacklisted. Senior entertainment editor Brandy Victorian rounds up the newest cultural offerings you should explore. You should watch Everything's Trash, a free-form comedy centered on the chaotic life of a 30-something podcaster. Written, co-produced, and starred by Phoebe Robinson. Me Time, Regina Hall and Kevin Hart star in this Netflix comedy about a stay-at-home dad who reconnects with his former best friend for a wild weekend while his wife and kids are away. The Bride. In this thriller, Natalie plays a young woman whose attendance at a posh destination wedding in England doesn't go quite as planned. You should listen to Trials to Triumphs through candid conversations with colleagues and close friends. Dear White People star Ashley Blaine Featherston Jenkins explores the dark moments that turned out to be people's biggest testimonies on this own podcast. Scam Goddess. Carly actress Lacey Mosley breaks down real-life cases of fraud in weekly episodes of the series, which received the 2022 Best Crime Podcast Award from iHeartRadio. The next article is titled The New Festival on the Block, as the Essence Festival of Culture makes its in-person return. It's adding an exciting new element for emerging filmmakers. Sidra Smith is on a mission to find the next Ryan Coogler or Ava DuVernay, aka the next Black storyteller. And through the creation of the inaugural Essence Film Festival. She's set to do just that. This is another dope thing that Essence is bringing to Black culture, says Smith, executive producer, Essence Studios. We are excited to continue to serve Black women deeply. The vision of Essence Studios, when it launched in 2020, was to build a streaming platform packed with original programming to support emerging artists on a global scale. But just as the team got to work on creating this robust digital hub, COVID-19 hit. However, there was a silver lining. Smith and her crew were able to transform the events that were supposed to happen in person into virtual offerings that could live on the platform. First up was a wellness house chat with experts conversing about everything from meal prep to mental health. The success of that event set off a domino effect of booming content on the platform. Show Me Your Walk, HBCU Edition, a commencement celebration, was launched next, followed by the Women Led Entrepreneur Summit, Boss Up Edition, and the male-focused Dear Black Men. Then, the studio was tasked with bottling the intoxicating energy of the Essence Festival of Culture, presented by Coca-Cola, EFOC, into a virtual event, which it successfully did for 2 years. This summer, EFOC is back in person for the first time since 2019, and with a new element, a film festival giving Black creators the opportunity to showcase their talent in front of the community for whom their art was created. The joy for me is all of these emerging filmmakers who are going to be able to say they premiered their movie at the Essence Festival of Culture in New Orleans, Smith says. That's the audience for the stories that we're trying to tell. Another exciting aspect for Smith is the opportunity to educate festival goers about the ways in which Black people can contribute behind the scenes. A lot of people of color aren't seen in costume design, catering, craft services, cinematography, and transportation, she says. We're using a large part of the film festival to inspire people of color to go after some of those jobs. After the film festival's coming out party in the Big Easy, the goal is for it to exist annually outside of EFOC. Smith adds that she also wants the event to become a destination for distributors to buy content from our community. Essence Studios is here for emerging storytellers, she says. We want to nurture and support creators of color. Our goal is to support people who would never otherwise have an opportunity to really be seen. The next article is titled Heat Wave, from a deep dive into a family's buried history to a steamy second chance romance. These books are like mini summer vacations. Soul Ties. Inspired by the tale of a real-life haunted stop on the Underground Railroad in Massachusetts, Lisa Williamson Rosenberg's Embers on the Wind cast the safe house as the fiery final resting place of two formerly enslaved women and a modern-day beacon for Black women seeking their own brand of freedom. But liberation in the present is elusive until they find their connection to the home's lingering souls. Fly Away, How You Grow Wings by Rima might be labeled a YA title, but the themes it explores, abuse, colorism, mental illness, classism, make it a compelling read for all. When sisters Zam and Sheta leave their Nigerian home to follow divergent paths, they have no idea they will be dramatically reunited, each holding the key to the other's redemption. Intimates. Photographer Casey Harris is completely game when she unexpectedly finds herself the star of her bestie's plus-size lingerie campaign. After all, she's in love with her body. The only problem, her nemesis is behind the camera. In the accidental pinup, author Danielle Jackson drops us into a charming tale set in Chicago, where fierce competitors reluctantly find their way to love. Homegoing. Parish by Latoya Watkins opens in an outhouse in Jerusalem, Texas in 1955. What happens under the moon beams that filter an improvised wooden roof will reverberate through the Turner family for generations. The depth of that impact only becomes clear when the family matriarch, Helen Jean, lies dying, and her children and grandchildren journey to her bedside, laden with passed-down secrets, resentment, and trauma. Harlem Shake. The eight short interconnected tales in Sadiq Fofana's Stories from the Tenants Downstairs give readers a peek into the lives of the dynamic residents of Banneker Homes. It's impossible not to get sucked into this debut effort, in which folks struggle to preserve their security and forge bright futures, even as gentrification raises rents and swallows their Harlem neighborhood block by block. Razor Sharp, poet Rio Cortez's first full-length collection, Golden Axe, uses Afro-pioneerism as its theme. Cortez examines how her family came to the American West after Reconstruction and reimagines the landscape through the lens of Black people who both embody and defy its realities. In the process, we are pushed to envision our own futures on the frontier, united by a collective aspiration to freedom. Ring the Alarm. In Under the Skin, the Hidden Toll of Racism on American Lives and the Health of Our Nation, former Essence executive editor Linda Villarosa explains the impact of racism on the health of Black people in America, with real-life stories of discrimination and featuring statistics detailing how the healthcare system fails us. She airs the nation's dirty hospital linens and urges meaningful reform. Heat Rises, Juana Jackson's 2020 romance Real Men Knit, introduced the world to the Strong Brothers who took over their adoptive mother's Harlem knitting shop following her passing. We revisit the family in Not Again, picking up the thread after an appearance in a firefighter charity calendar results in Lucas colliding with love in the form of his former high school crush, Sydney. Tangled feelings and bodies ensue. The next article is titled Hot Stuff. In Long Past Summer, Arthur Kirwan deftly transverses decades to tell the story of New York City attorney Michaela Marchard's intertwined relationships with her best friend and her first love. A not-so-chance meeting one steamy summer day forces her to reconsider what she thinks she knows about friendship, love, and herself. Here we talk to Kirwan about her book and the unique charms of the warmer months. Why is summer your favorite season? Kirwan responds, I adore summertime. My ideal temperature is 78 degrees and balmy. As far as I'm concerned, There are only two seasons, summer and the season that is not summer. Winter, I think they call it. Which songs signal to you that it's summer? She replied, I like the way The Kissing Game by High Five, Summertime by DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, and Got to Give It Up by Marvin Gaye. Summer fling or summer vacation? She responds, the part of me who likes romance and angst, whirlwind love and sorrowful partings says summer fling. The sensible part that's like, Michaela says, summer vacation, I'm essentially sensible. You've lived in the Bronx and the Bay Area. Which has the best summers? Kwan responds, my summers in Cali were much closer to the idyllic descriptions of summers in the book. But I have to say, summers in New York, even with the concrete swelter and wall-to-wall people, are better. Nowhere beats summer in the city. If you could give your younger self one piece of relationship advice, what would it be? Quinn responds, like Michaela, I was a people pleaser growing up. So I'd say don't lose track of yourself and what you want by trying to be what your partner wants. What do you want readers to walk away with when they finish Long Past Summer? Kwan responds, I want readers, particularly Black women, to run the gamut of emotions with Michaela. Love, lust, jealousy, heartache, and joy, and walk away satisfied. I also want them to see her as a reflection of themselves, a woman of a certain age in love and being loved, who is unafraid to wait for a relationship that fulfills her. To say any more would be a spoiler. The next article is titled Justice for All. Amid a flurry of political activity, esteemed civil rights attorney Janae Nelson has taken the helm of the Legal Defense Fund. I sat down with Janae Nelson, President and Director, Counsel of the Legal Defense Fund, LDF, over Zoom on the day after the U.S. Senate voted to confirm Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson as the first Black woman Supreme Court Justice. Acknowledging the enormity of the moment, Nelson and I, two Black female attorneys, even did a little dance in our seats. Our joy was reminiscent of the scene from a Black lady sketch show that celebrated the first all-Black lady courtroom. Nelson's elation was palpable as she described how she had been in the Senate gallery watching a Black woman vice president presiding over the proceedings to confirm the nomination of the first Black woman to the Supreme Court. It was just awesome. Nelson is no stranger to watershed events. She assumed her current role from predecessor Sherrilyn Ifill in March of this year, marking yet another momentous beginning for Black women. This leadership transition was the first time since LDF was founded by the late Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall 82 years ago that a woman had succeeded another woman in the group's head position. During Ifill's tenure, LDF grew almost fourfold, expanding from a staff of approximately 55 to 200. It also increased its budget, assembled an award-winning communications team, grew its offices in the nation's capital, and became more widely recognized nationally. Today, most people are aware of the organization, which was created in 1940 to serve and represent people in the legal sphere in order to defend their civil rights. Reflecting on the exceptional career path that led her to stepping into LDS leadership role, Nelson shares that she didn't always know that she would be a lawyer, despite often being told she should become one. It's something that people say to girls who have strong opinions and who are competent enough to speak up and share it with other people. Nelson says with a chuckle, "But I really didn't know what a lawyer was. I didn't have any lawyers in my family or in my community. I didn't meet anyone who was a lawyer until law school, really. But I always had a keen sense of justice and fairness." A glance at Nelson's prolific resume shows accolade upon accolade since she graduated from UCLA School of Law in 1996. These include successfully challenging Texas's voter ID laws and helping to get a death row inmate's sentence commuted by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2003, all while balancing family life as a mother. "I don't balance it perfectly, and I think many people have said that balance is not 50-50 every day," she admits. "There are highs and lows. There are periods of intensity and then periods where you must pull back and recharge. And that's something that is a work in progress. But the way I keep myself grounded is to put my family first at all times. And by making sure that I have a circle of friends with whom I can cut up and have a good time with. People with whom I can enjoy some levity in life." Nelson grew up in New York, where she lived in public housing, an experience that helped shape how she understood the world. "I saw segregation and concentrated poverty up close," she explains. "I knew that there was something deeply unfair about that and that it didn't quite make sense. But I didn't have the language to name it and to name the cause. Then when I got to college, I started hanging out with some law students, and they had the language for what I witnessed. They were able to talk about discrimination and talk about structural racism and talk about inequity and disparities. All of that made sense." Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.